So this paper is called Self-Consciousness, Sensory Consciousness, and Indirect Discourse, and it falls in three parts. The first part considers two different accounts of indirect discourse in order to bring out a distinction between two kinds of report. Those given from within what they report, which say how things are for the subject, and those given from outside, which say how things are in themselves. The second part draws on this distinction to shed light on the philosophical idea of self-consciousness, the idea that Aristotle captures by saying that the mind thinks itself. And then it draws on this idea to put in place a further distinction between an understanding that proceeds from within and an understanding from outside. And then finally, in the third part, I exploit this last distinction to explain what's at stake in the apparent disagreement between those who acknowledge that cases of sensory consciousness are conceptual acts and those who profess to see no reason to think this. So it helps to begin with indirect discourse. Consider the following. One, Galileo said that the earth moves. It's natural to think of this as a sentence that contains the following sentence. Two, the earth moves. But opinions differ as to how one is to be understood. Here are two very different accounts. The first account says that although the same form of words occurs embedded in one and unembedded as two, the referent of the earth when embedded is not the referent of the earth when unembedded. Rather, the referent of the earth when embedded is the sense of the earth when unembedded. And as sense determines reference, so the sense of the earth when embedded is not the sense of the earth when unembedded. The sense of a referring term is a way of being given its object, ab der Gegebensein der Gegebenstand. So the sense of the earth when embedded is not a way of being given the heavenly body that this term refers to when unembedded, but a way of being given a way of being given this heavenly body. Like considerations apply to moods, insofar as it is a referring term. The effect is to throw the senses of the unembedded referring terms into the world, into the realm of what is given, the realm of reference, by treating them as objects of reference. This is achieved through introducing a complex object, a thought, or a proposition that contains these objects of reference as its elements and is itself referred to by the embedded form of words, which when embedded functions as a complex name of this complex object. We might call this the Phrygian account, but no claim is made here as to whether anyone ever held this account, let alone whether Frege did. I introduce the label only to provide context for the following protest due to Donald Davidson. Quote, if we could recover our pre-Phrygian semantic innocence, it would seem to us plainly incredible that the words the earth moves, as they figure after the words Galileo said that, mean anything different or refer to anything else than is their wont in other environments. It's natural to think that the function of a piece of indirect discourse is, inter alia, to say what someone said on a certain occasion. Where to say what someone said on a certain occasion is to express what he said by using a sentence that is the same in sense, not merely as itself in other environments, but as a sentence used by the speaker on the occasion. It's natural to think, then, that a piece of indirect discourse contains a same-in-sense sentence. But that's just what Phrygian semantic experience, innocence of experience, what Phrygian semantic experience as represented by the foregoing account denies. Because on that account, a piece of indirect discourse doesn't contain any sentence that's the same-in-sense as a sentence that the speaker used on the occasion in question. Davidson, by contrast, retains the natural thought. But he thinks that, insofar as a piece of indirect discourse contains a same-in-sense sentence, its form cannot be that of a sentence that contains the same-in-sense sentence, but must rather be that of two separate sentences. So three, we have Galileo said that the earth moves. Now here, the second sentence is the same in sense sentence, and the first is a sentence that contains a demonstrative, and as such signifies only insofar as it's uttered in a certain context, namely directly before an utterance of the second sentence. The idea is that the parataxis of an utterance of the first sentence with an utterance of the second performs the function of indirect discourse, not merely to express what someone said, but equally to identify him as the one who said it. And this is achieved through the first sentence identifying both a speaker through the name Galileo and the second sentence, and it does that through referring through the demonstrative to the utterance of that sentence. And then the first sentence is explained as true, just in case the identified sentence is the same in sense as a sentence uttered by the identified speaker. Now, the Phrygian account and this pre-Phrygian alternative both generate many interesting questions of detail, and determining whether either can be made good would require much discussion. But for present purposes, we need not consider these questions, and need not decide between the accounts, because what matters here is only what they seek to affirm. In the case of the pre-Phrygian account, as represented here by Davidson, that a piece of indirect discourse contains the same in sense sentence, and in the case of the Phrygian account, that it doesn't. But really what we need is something much more abstract, which I'm going to put as follows. An utterance or inscription of a sentence is an act of conceptual capacities or concepts with a certain unity or togetherness. The idea of such an act is to be understood through the idea of being the same in sense. Utterances of sentences from different languages, but the same in sense, are acts of the same concepts, conceptual capacities with the same unity. Whereas utterances of sentences different in sense are acts of different concepts. And it's not only utterances or inscriptions that are acts of concepts. The same concepts with the same unity can be an act both at the level of expressed thought or language and at the level of thought that isn't expressed. A piece of indirect discourse is an example of an act of conceptual capacities with a certain unity at the linguistic level. As we might say, its function is to identify someone and to say that he says something. It's to report someone's saying something in this sense. Where the two accounts differ is on what this function comes to. And this difference may now be put as follows. For the pre-Phrygian account, a piece of indirect discourse reports someone saying something through actualizing the same concepts that are actualized in what it reports with the same unity. Whereas for the Phrygian account, a piece of indirect discourse reports someone saying something not through actualizing the same concepts that are actualized in what it reports, but through actualizing different concepts. Now that spells out a distinction that might be put in more imagistic terms. For the first, a piece of indirect discourse, this is for the pre-Phrygian account, a piece of indirect discourse speaks the mind of the speaker it identifies, whereas for the second, it merely speaks the mind of the one giving the report. Or for the first, a piece of indirect discourse looks out from what the speaker said by expressing what he said, whereas for the second, it only looks out from what was said by the one giving the report. Or, for the first, a piece of indirect discourse is given from within what it reports, whereas for the second, it's given from outside. Or, as McDowell puts it, from sideways. Now, we've so far been concerned with opaque or notional indirect discourse, as opposed to its transparent or relational variant. But it might help to broaden the focus to take in the latter. An example would be, for Galileo said of the earth that it moves. Now, as this doesn't even seem to contain a complete sentence, it bypasses the difficulties that attach to its opaque variant. Its mark, as a piece of transparent indirect discourse, is that it doesn't function through actualizing the same concepts that are actualized in what it reports. The point of its not placing the singular term inside of that clause is to make this explicit. As such, although what it reports consists in an utterance of a complete sentence by Galileo, it leaves what Galileo said in this utterance unexpressed. Well, it's tempting to think that it doesn't leave it all unexpressed, because it does function through actualising some of the same concepts that are actualised in Galileo's utterance. And that's the whole point of it putting "it moves" after the occurrence of that. So it's tempting to say that it does speak some of Galileo's mind. But it doesn't speak his whole mind, because although it looks out at the same object as Galileo does, it doesn't look out at it from what he said. And as such, it's not given wholly from within what it reports, but at least in part from outside. That's not quite for the same reason that a piece of a pagan direct discourse on the Phrygian account is given from outside. That's given from outside because it functions through actualising different concepts from those actualised in what it reports. But this is given from outside, to the extent that it is, because it doesn't function through actualising the same concepts that are actualised in the reported act. And we can now make a more general point by speaking more generally of someone or someone's exing something. A report of someone or something's exing something is given from within just in case it functions through actualising the same concepts that are actualised in what it reports with the same unity, whereas a report of this is given from outside just in case it doesn't function in this manner. And that's a stark distinction, and we can now draw distinctions within it between reports that are given wholly or only partially from within. One advantage of putting the point in terms of concepts, conceptual capacities, is that it enables the replacements for X not to be restricted to verbs for linguistic act types, because acts of concepts are not restricted to the linguistic level. So, for example, for a pre-Phrygian, an example of a report given from within would be 5, Galileo thinks that the earth moves. But the general point is the one to focus on, because it lets us separate reports into 2 kinds. Those that say how things are for the subject, for the speaker, say, whom they identify, and those that say how things are in themselves. The first are those given from within, and the second are those given from outside. So for the Phrygian account, even pieces of indirect discourse say how things are in themselves. This account does not recognise reports that say how things are for the subject at all. In this respect, it treats pieces of indirect discourse as the same as pieces of discourse about bits of mere nature. This tree is blooming, for instance. Of course, this account would insist that pieces of indirect discourse report acts of conceptual capacities, whereas this tree is blooming reports an act of merely natural powers. But that makes no difference to the present point, which concerns not what is reported, but the manner of reporting it. That in each case, the reports are given from outside of the reporting acts. And that brings out a trivial, but I think not insignificant, consequence of what's been said so far, that insofar as an act can be reported from within, it is an act of concepts. An act that is not an act of concepts can only be reported from outside. And that will matter in what follows. But first, it will help to speak to an idea that we now have the resources to address, the philosophical idea of self-consciousness. I speak of the philosophical idea of self-consciousness, and I'm thinking of the idea that people gesture at. Aristotle speaks of the mind thinking itself. Its thinking is a thinking of thinking. Locke speaks of self-consciousness as the consciousness that is inseparable from thinking. More recently, my host in Leipzig, Sebastian Mördl, speaks of self-consciousness as a consciousness that's internal to that of which it is a consciousness. I will understand it here as the idea of a form of consciousness, a manner of having in view, which crucially is not a form of consciousness that's separable from what it's a consciousness of. I think this idea does run through the history of philosophy. But what does it mean? What does it come to? And to answer this question, I think it might help to place the idea in a specific setting. So we turn to one. Insofar as one is understood as speaking the mind of the speaker it identifies, it looks out from what he said, and in so doing refers to the earth and its way of being. Whereas, insofar as it's understood merely as speaking the mind of the one giving the report, it doesn't look out from what is said by the speaker it identifies, because it refers not to the earth and its way of being, but to a complex object of a different sort, a thought or a proposition. It's tempting to say that on this second Phrygean way of understanding one, one brings what the speaker said into view, not by looking out from it, but by looking down on it. And that way of putting things raises the question, is there a way to bring what the speaker said into view that doesn't look down on it, but instead continues to look out from it? That is there a way to bring what the speaker said into view not through expressing something other than what he said, and in so doing looking down on what he said, but through expressing what he said? And it might seem that there isn't, for it might seem that there are only two possibilities. It's possible to express what someone said, and in so doing to refer to the earth and its way of being. And it's possible to express something other than what he said, and in so doing to refer to a thought or a proposition. The first brings what the speaker referred to into view, but it doesn't bring what he said into view. It leaves that, as it were, behind the lens. Whereas the second does bring what the speaker said into view, but only by looking down on it. But these are not the only possibilities. And this comes out in one of our earlier ways of asking the question. We asked, is there a way to bring what someone said into view, not through expressing something other than what he said, but through expressing what he said? And the answer is, yes, there is. Namely, through expressing what he said. To express what someone said in language just is to bring what he said into view, but without looking down on it. And there needn't be anything metaphorical about this talk of being in view. What someone said is often literally put before our eyes, not through being referred to, but through being expressed in a sentence. And for the pre-Phrygean, that's just what one achieves. In this light, we can understand the idea of self-consciousness. One manner of having in view is through looking down. In general, it's that of sense and effort, of being given something in a certain way. On the conception of what that comes to, that's implicit in the Phrygean account, on which the mark of a way of being given something is that it's a form of consciousness that is separable from what it's a consciousness of, where that means the expression of this form of consciousness is not the expression of what it's a consciousness of. So we have that in one on the Phrygean account, because if you remember on that account, one is not itself the expression of the thought it refers to, and in so doing brings into view. And that's because in one, the senses that compose that thought aren't expressed, but referred to, and different senses are expressed instead. But that is not the only form of consciousness. What someone said, or more generally what someone thinks, is brought into view through its expression. Expression in language is another manner of having in view. And it's not a form of consciousness that is separable from what it's a consciousness of. Not because the expression of this form of consciousness is the expression of what it brings into view, no. But because this form of consciousness isn't something that's expressed at all. Rather, this form of consciousness just is the expression of what it brings into view. Self-consciousness is expression in language. So, we distinguish two manners of being in view. The first through being expressed, and the second through being given. And in this light, we can introduce the distinction between an understanding that proceeds from within and an understanding from outside. An expression of what someone says or thinks is an actualization of the same concepts that are actualized in their saying or thinking it, with the same unity. And the mark of an understanding from within is that it contains expressions of this sort. So paradigmatically, it contains pieces of opaque indirect discourse of the form I think that, FA, and NA thinks that, FA alike, on the pre-Fugean account of what those come to. But more generally, an understanding from within consists in reports of someone's Xing something that are given from within, whereas an understanding from outside consists in reports of someone or something's Xing something that are given from outside. And it's worth noting that the fact that these reports can be given both in the first person, I think that blah blah blah, and in the third, NN thinks that blah blah blah, shows that the distinction between these two manners of understanding is not the distinction between an understanding that's first personal and another that's third personal. What matters is not the grammatical person of the reports, but only whether they're given from within. But this isn't all. In general, the aspiration of an understanding from within is to understand subjectivity, on the conception of subjectivity implicit in the foregoing. On this conception, subjectivity is what is said in reports that say how things are for the subject. And that way of putting it brings out that the mark of an understanding from within is not merely what it seeks to understand, but the manner in which it seeks to understand it. When we say that an understanding from within seeks to understand what is said in reports that say how things are for the subject, we don't just specify what it seeks to understand, namely what's said in these reports. We equally specify how it seeks to understand it, namely in reports with that character. And we can shed more light on that and on the topic of sensory consciousness by moving to consider this topic, and a good way to centre it is on the very famous remark of Kant's, thoughts without content or entity. That remark is widely taken to reflect a certain idea of how the world is given, on which the world is given through sensory consciousness, or as it's sometimes put, through experience. An understanding from within that accepts that Kantian idea, but seeks to articulate the idea further, would consist in reports of sensory consciousness that are given from within. And as such, it would take it for granted that these cases are conceptual acts. And because sensory consciousness is an aspect of subjectivity, it would understand sensory consciousness as a way of being given the world, one that is distinctively sensory in character. As it's sensory, it's sensory consciousness. But as it's a way of being given the world, it's equally an aspect of what is thought or said. A natural candidate would be what's known as a perceptual demonstrative mode of presentation, expressible by, for example, this pink ice cube. That's an example of Wilfred Sellers. I'd like to stay with that example to develop this idea of a sensory way of being given the world further. Suppose that someone, NN, thinks something that he could express as follows. This is 6. This pink ice cube is melting. Is it possible for someone else to report NN's thinking, what he expresses with 6, from within, by means of a report that contains 6 as a same in sentence? So someone else could say, this is 7. NN thinks that this pink ice cube is melting. Well, yes, it seems that it is, but only if, at the time of giving the report, the reporter bears the same nexus to the same object as NN. Only then can the sentence in the that clause have the same sensory significance that it has on NN's lips. It might be thought that there's only one person to whom the object could be given in the specific way that the demonstrative expresses on the lips of NN, namely NN. But even if we grant that, it needn't be doubted that this specific way of being given the object is a species of a more generic, but still sensory way of being given it that anyone can enjoy. And that would be enough for a match in sensory significance. In this light, it seems that someone could report the same act that 7 reports, equally from within, but in a manner that abstracts away from everything but the demonstrative presentation that the act contains, but which equally registers the sensory character of the act through using the verb to see. So we can have eight. NN sees this pink ice cube. And in this light, it seems that someone could give a further report of the act, also from within, which abstracts away even from its demonstrative character, but still registers its sensory character through using the same verb. Nine, NN sees a pink ice cube. Important point is, just like eight, this nine reports what is in fact the act reported by seven. But whereas someone can give seven or eight only insofar as they enjoy the same generic but still demonstrative way of being given the object that the act contains, the capacity to give nine doesn't involve standing to the object in this sensory nexus. It reports the same act as seven and eight through actualizing many of the same concepts that are actualized in the act it reports, but it doesn't actualize the concept or the conceptual capacity that constitutes the act's specifically demonstrative character. And this lets us say that whereas not just the acts they report, but the reports constituted by seven and eight are cases of sensory consciousness, as they involve the reporters standing in a sensory nexus to an object, nine is merely the report of such a case. But it's still given from within what it reports. And this comes out in NN's own capacity to give a first-person report, equally from within, which actualizes the same concepts, with the same unity. So this would be 10, I see a pink ice cube. There's a difference, however. As this report is first-personal, it's a case of sensory consciousness, and as such it presupposes that the one who gives it stands to the object in a sensory nexus, and as such can refer to it demonstratively. Perhaps by going on by saying, namely, that one. So that develops further this idea of sensory consciousness as a distinctively sensory way of being given an object, and as such an aspect of what's thought or said. But there are pressures, philosophical pressures, that might lead us to reject this conception of sensory consciousness. To see this, return to the demonstrative expression, this pink ice cube. As noted earlier, a demonstrative signifies only insofar as the sentence containing it is uttered in a suitable context. In the case of 6, this would be a context in which the speaker stands in a suitable nexus to an object that conforms to the conception internal to the Art der Gegebenheit that the demonstrative expresses. This would be the conception expressed by the words pink ice cube. The internality of this conception to the mode of presentation is reflected in the demonstratives being not a bare or non-conceptual this, but a conceptual this such. But now consider a first-person report from within that matches 8. So this would be 11. I see this pink ice cube. And now suppose it is said that the demonstrative way of being given an object contained in the act that 11 reports itself contains no conception of the object. It is, as we might say, a conceptual form in that it's an aspect of what's thought or said, but it's a bare form in that it contains no conceptual matter. This means that 11 contains conceptual matter that's not contained in the act it reports. A more accurate report of the act from within would be 12. I see this. As this merely contains a bare this, it does not say what it is that is given in the act that it reports. In general, there's no such thing as saying what it is that is given by expressing how it is given, insofar as that in which it is given lacks conceptual matter. And for this reason, cases of sensory consciousness that lack conceptual matter may be said to be blind. Now that might be a way to understand Kant's further remark, intuitions without concepts are blind. But no exegetical claim is made here. The important point is that this blindness or to change the sensory modality of the metaphor, this silence is reflected in the conceptual inarticulacy of any report of such a case, insofar as the report is from within. And 12, I see this as an example. The idea that experiences can only be reported from within in this inarticulate manner is at the heart of the myth of the given. And there are real pressures to endorse this idea. For example, it can be tempting to think of 11, as I see this pink ice cube, as containing an infallible report of a much more minimal conceptual act, one that only actualizes the concepts associated with the words for the relevant, proper, and common sensibles. And at an even barer minimum, one that only actualizes the concept associated with the word pink. So someone in the grip of this temptation might put it, I see pink. And it can be tempting for someone in the grip of this temptation to think that even after giving this report, there is still one more step to take, namely pointing to something that is simply received in experience. And this last temptation has many sources, one of which is the subject's attempt to explain the putative infallibility of the report I see pink by using something that's given to him in sensory consciousness as a paradigm of what he means by pink. And for this, it doesn't matter how anyone else uses pink, or even how he used this word in the past. As Anskin puts it in her discussion of this temptation, adopting the persona of the tempted subject, quote, that this, which I have now, is what I, now at least, mean by pink, and that I cannot be wrong about it, that is the most natural thought in the world. And it's crucial that the demonstrative here is bare and not conceptual, as the subject's aim is to set up a conceptual capacity associated with pink on the basis of what he's presently given. This capacity can't be an act in his being given it. And as such, no report of the act in which it's given can be an act of this capacity, insofar as the report is given from within. But insofar as the act can serve to found this capacity, it must be an act in which something is given in a certain way. And that's why it's tempting for the subject to try to report it through something on the lines of the inarticulate 12, I see this. That, I think, is the context in which to place Wittgenstein's remark. So in the end, when one is doing philosophy, one gets to the point where one would just like to emit an inarticulate sound. But for now, the point is that the temptation that we are presently considering can only be felt by someone who is, perhaps unreflectively, proceeding from within. And as such, perhaps only incorrectly, acknowledges that experiences are at least conceptual in form. The perhaps equally inchoate temptation is to suppose that, even so, they are not conceptual in matter. But here's a striking fact. In contemporary philosophy, this is a sociological remark, in contemporary philosophy, almost no one thinks that there are cases of sensory consciousness that are even conceptually formed. Most see no reason to think that what they call experiences, cases of sensory consciousness, or at least the elements in such cases in which their sensory character consists, are acts of concepts at all. Think of a case of sensory consciousness as owing its sensory character to one of its elements is to think of it as having some non-sensory elements. So here I'm using the phrases a case of sensory consciousness and an experience to mean, well, either the sensory element in such a case, or if the case doesn't have any non-sensory ones, just such a case. But that's a fiddly point. Insofar as a case of sensory consciousness is not a conceptual act, it follows that it cannot be reported from within. There is no such thing as a report of such a case that says how things are for its subject. Someone could come out with 9 or 10 and intend them as reports of such a case, but the reports could only be given from outside. In this respect, they would be the same as reports of merely natural powers, such as this tree is blooming. And most contemporary philosophers see no reason to think otherwise. Oh, sorry. God, I'm missing the air. So there'd be the same as reports of merely natural power. But that's not the only consequence. The same blindness that afflicts cases of sensory consciousness thought of as conceptually in form but not in matter marks any case of sensory consciousness that's conceived in the manner that dominates contemporary philosophy, and as such can only be reported from outside. There is no such thing as saying what it is that is given in such a case by expressing how it is given in such a case, because such a case is not any kind of conceptual act, and so doesn't contain any Art de Gegebenheit. It's supposed to be a case of sensory consciousness, and yet, as it might be put in, I think, an illuminating pun, no aspect of sensory consciousness belongs to the realm of sense. No aspect of sensory consciousness can be expressed in language. No aspect of it is even potentially in the scope of self-consciousness, as this idea was explained above. And this expulsion of sensory consciousness from sense can be made vivid by returning to 10. That was introduced as a report from within, but the expulsion fixes it that it can only be given from outside. Considered either way, the report looks out at an object from a way of being given it, namely from what the report expresses with a pink ice cube. But considered the first way, from within, this mode of presentation is contained in the reported act, whereas considered the second way, it isn't. So considered the first way, the report looks out at the object from the way of being given it that the reporting act contains, and as such from within the act. Whereas considered the second way, it looks out at the object from a way of being given it that the act doesn't contain, and as such from outside the act. And that's because considered the second way, the reported act does not contain any Art de Gegebenheit. The act contains things that can be referred to, a perceiver called I, an object called a pink ice cube, and a relation called seeing that holds between them, but it doesn't contain anything from the realm of sense. Insofar as cases of sensory consciousness are not conceptual acts, no case contains anything from this realm. And as such, sensory consciousness cannot be a way the world is given. It can only be a bit of the world. And as I said, most contemporary philosophers see no reason to think otherwise. And I think it's possible to offer a diagnosis as to why. It's because they, I suspect quite unreflectively, proceed from outside rather than from within. If someone accepts the Kantian idea that the world is given through sensory consciousness and seeks to articulate it further in an understanding from within, then they already see that experience is conceptual, at least in form. But if someone purports to accept that Kantian idea, but proceeds only from outside, then it's hard to see how they could have any reason to think that experience is a conceptual act. Suppose someone purports to accept that idea, but purports to remain neutral on whether experience is conceptual. They might give a report such as 10, and intend it as a report of an experience. But the report could only be from outside, because if it was from within, then it would follow that experience is a conceptual act, and their position of neutrality would be undermined. As such, there's nothing for them to consider when they consider what's contained in what 10 reports, except bits of the world. They are already treating sensory consciousness as a bit of the world, so it's hard to see how they could object to a position that fixes it that it can only be a bit of the world. Though, of course, those who see no reason to accept the conceptuality of experience not only think there's no reason to accept it, they think there's a reason not to accept it. Namely, something like this. It is just a datum that there are beings, creatures, that do not possess conceptual capacities but still enjoy sensory consciousness. Refusing to think that cases of sensory consciousness are conceptual acts makes it possible to acknowledge this datum with ease. But I think this supposed reason is more obscure than its advocates seem to think. To think that certain beings that lack concepts still enjoy sensory consciousness is to think that those beings possess some form of subjectivity. So if that's to be any kind of reason, the idea of subjectivity needs to be explained. And this essay contained an explanation. Subjectivity is what is said in reports that say how things are for the subject. Given this, to think that certain beings without concepts enjoy sensory consciousness is to think that it's possible to speak the minds of these beings, to say how things are for them, even though they lack concepts. And that makes no sense. Without a different explanation of subjectivity, the very idea of beings that lack concepts but enjoy sensory consciousness is unintelligible. Of course, anyone who takes the existence of these beings as a datum can't think that this idea is unintelligible. So they must be working with a different explanation of subjectivity. And I'm afraid this is another sociological claim. To the best of my knowledge, no one has ever said what this different explanation could be. We tend to be told merely that the idea of subjectivity is the idea of how things are for the subject, or what things are like for the subject. But these phrases don't constitute an alternative to the explanation of subjectivity contained in this essay, because this explanation is not opposed to these phrases. On the contrary, it says how they are to be understood. Without a different explanation, it's not clear what it means to say that there are beings that lack concepts but still possess subjectivity. On the face of it, it might seem that the nexus between those who acknowledge the conceptuality of experience and all those who don't is one of disagreement. But disagreement presupposes a shared subject matter, and that's not what there is here. There is a radical difference of concern. One party seeks an understanding from within, the other seeks an understanding from outside. And that fixes it, that the phrase sensory consciousness has a different significance on their respective lips. One uses it to indicate an aspect of subjectivity, an aspect of what is said in reports that say how things are for the subject, whereas the other uses it to try to refer to a bit of the world. As such, it would be wrong to think that there's a single Kantian idea that both accept, as opposed to a single form of words that each puts to a very different use. And it'd be wrong to assume that those who do not proceed from within are succeeding in referring to anything at all when they use the word experience and its cognates. The reason why it isn't clear what it means to say that there are beings that lack concepts but enjoy experience is that it's not clear what it means to say that there are cases of subjectivity that are not conceptual acts. Insofar as someone who purports to be neutral about the conceptuality of experience uses the word experiences, it's not clear what they have in mind. If I had more time, it would be good to take this general point further, because I think that this difference in concern between what I'm calling proceeding from within and proceeding from outside underwrites many of the apparent disagreements in philosophy, and that the apparent disagreement I've considered here is only an example. But that's enough for now.